a marketing analyst's title. And in that world, demographics are very, very important. They're also important in many other institutions within our country, politics, also for academics and so on. But studying demographics, the makeup of customers and potential students and voters and so on is very important, especially as pertains to generational differences. Back when I was a teenager in the 1960s, a term came into that study called the generation gap. Remember, we used to talk about that a lot? That was pretty much non-existent prior to then. Gaps between generations in terms of how they viewed things, educational background, opportunities in life, professions, choices that they make, opinions that they had, were very little difference between generations every 18 to 20 years. It's been studied since probably the 1940s, 1950s, when the population really began to explode. Right now, though, we're at 333 million people in the country, and that continues to grow. There are at present seven generational age groups that have been defined within that world of demographics. I'd like to just review them with you. I don't want to focus on them individually as much as I want to talk about the gaps between them and how they've increased over the years. Because today, the gaps between generations are much greater than they were in the 1960s. And those gaps are very important, very significant, because they're leading to a divided nation and getting even worse. So first, the first generation that was identified was called the Greatest Generation. These are individuals born before 1924. Anybody in that group? No, not even close. I mean, you would have to be over 98 years old to be in that group. And that group, is, as you can imagine, is considerably diminishing. And that's very sad, too, because much of what we do as a nation today is based upon the work that they did. I mean, they overcame the Great Depression. They won World War II. And they're just a wonderful group of people that we are losing. We've seen that, I think, probably in the last 10 to 15 years of the church, we've lost so many of our older ministers and so on. I'm not sure anywhere in this category, but they were significantly influenced by it. My father was in this category. He was born in 1918, and he had me when my mother birthed me when I was 30. She was 37. He was also 37. So I come from older parents. I tend to have more of the tendencies of the great gen than I do of the either the silent gen or the boomers as a result. Those are the next two categories. So right now, great gen is under 800,000 people in the country. And again, they're dying fairly rapidly. They may be completely gone by, you know, 2-3 years. The next one was the silent generation, the generation just after the great gen, born in 1925 and lived between 1925 and 1945. You said it's a 20-year gap. It was also a 21-year gap between 1945 and 1924, which is when the great gen was born prior to that. So that's fairly consistent with what we consider a generation, 20, 21 years. You'll see that, though, as I move through these, that's getting shorter, and there are reasons for that. There are presently 16 million silent gens right now. They're called silent, I think, mostly because the generation that went before them were very, very accomplished, and what they did, what they accomplished, and how they built the society, so that they were just normal, but because of the one that went before them were so profound, they're silent. And they don't typically speak up, share their opinions, and so on. But they're less than 5% of the population, and their age range is between 77 and 98. Do we have any of those in here? Anyone over 77? Okay. They don't want to raise their hand too high. They're silent. The next group is the baby boomers. We're more familiar with them because they were such a huge group and have dominated our society for the past, since their age, the age range, born in 1946, between 1946 and 1964. There's 70 million presently. They're starting to come down in number, obviously, as they age. They're still 21% of the population, and they're between age ranges of 58 and 76. I'm in that group. Anyone else? The boomers. Boomers do the wave. All right, so then there's the Gen Xers. Now, you'll notice this, that the boomers were about 20 years, maybe 18 to 20 years as a generation. The Gen Xers were born in 1965 through 1979. Now, that's only 14 years. And they were considerably less after the boomers exploded after the war. This group came down. They're presently 63.2% of the nation. I'm sorry, 63.2 million. So they're about 7 million less than the boomers. They're 19% of the population, and they're between ages of 43 and 57. Any of those? 40, 57? Good. They're actually, it seems, more represented than boomers. Then there's the Gen Ys coming after the Gen Xers. They're also known as the millennials. They're born between 1980 and 1997, so that's a 17-year age range. Now, this can also be broken into two groups. In the middle of that, between 1980 and 1997, the internet was invented by Al Gore. And that changed them. That changed their profile. So prior to the internet, they grew up without certain qualities and abilities, access to information, and so on. The reach of what they could actually find out was less. And then after 1991, it actually increased. So that's actually could be broken up into two. Right now, they still label it as one. And they are the largest group represented in the country now. That's 73.2 million. That's 22% of the population. And they're between the ages of 25 and 42. They've probably been waiting to raise their hand. So you can raise your hand now. Between 25 and 42? Okay. One. This is also helping to understand the demographics within the church. The demographics within the church skew much older than the demos of our nation. And there's a reason for that. If you look at the successful years, the really successful years of the church in this era, it was 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and since that time, it's kind of leveled out. So the Gen Ys could be two, Gen Ys or Gen IYs, and they're typically known as the millennials. The next group is Gen Zs. Gen Zs were born between 1998 and 2012. Now, you notice that's only 14 years. And the reason being, there's certain changes that are happening within society, including technology and other things, education, that are shortening those cycles and making them smaller demographic groups, though they may not be representative of a parental child, grandchild, and so on. It's more their characteristics that unite them. And those things are happening and changing so fast that they're getting smaller. They are presently 67 million in the country, 20% of the nation. And they're between the ages of 10 and 24. The last one, and this is a newer one, I haven't seen this one before, they're called Gen Alpha. I don't know why. I didn't research why the name Alpha. But they were born between 2013 and the present date. There's 43 million of them. It's kind of a second boomers. They used to refer to the millennials as echo boomers, but it seems like the Gen Zs are even more so. Lots of babies being born now. They are 12, almost 13% of the population, and they're between the ages of 0 and 10. You can see if you combine those two groups, if the Gen Alphas and Gen Zs were combined, that would be over 100 million in the country. So the country is getting younger, but the church is getting older. This is what we talk about on a council a lot. How do we appeal to that younger group? How do we help parents rear their children in the church? How do we reach them? It's actually quite complicated. This is a quote from Pew Research. Pew Research says that the factors associated with generational differences can be complex and overlapping. Researchers often think about three separate effects that can produce differences in attitudes between generations. The first is life cycle or age effects. So depending on how old you are, you have certain opinions about certain concepts or ideas about marriage. Obviously, if you're 20 and not married, you would have different ideas about marriage than someone who is 40, 45, 50, 70, and been married 50 years. Ideas about children, if you never had any of your own, you know exactly how to raise children, rear them, I should say. And you can tell current parents, with all the experience that they have, even grandparents, what they should do to raise good children, right? I could do that when I was 24. I'm being sarcastic, if you can't tell. Ideas about voting, if you're not of a voting age yet, or if you voted very little, you may have different ideas and perspectives about things like voting. This is influenced by your stage of life and your age itself. So those are what they call life cycle differences or age effects. The second category is period events, things, big things that happened during your life cycle, whether you were young or middle age or whatever, within your age group, period events like wars, social movements that were happening within the country, economic booms or busts. The Great Depression had a strong impact on the personalities and preferences of those who went through the Great Depression. Scientific or technological breakthroughs, this is another big one, and probably one that's happened probably within the last 20 to 30 years, and it keeps ramping up, and it keeps diminishing this group, making each one of them a smaller compartment based upon the technological breakthrough of your time. Probably most people don't realize these, but cell phones weren't very popular until 3 to 4 years into this 100-year period, this century. I think no one had a cell phone. If you were rich, you could have one of those. Remember the big cell phones where you had to have they were actually called car phones, mobile phones. You had this big, big Motorola box that weighed 50 pounds in your trunk, and the phone was huge. And I remember there's a line from a movie, very funny, Men in Black 3, where he goes back in time. How many have seen that movie? Will Smith, his partner picks up a phone, and it's this big, huge thing. And Will Smith says, "Don't put that big thing near your head," because of the radiation it gave off and so on. Well, they started getting much smaller and were much more commonplace. And by 2010, six-year-olds were carrying cell phones, smartphones. It's incredible how quickly that has happened. It seems like they've been around a long time, but they're fairly recent. And it's changed them, their ability to access information, reach their parents, and ask for guidance and decisions and so on. It's really changed that whole group. So technological breakthroughs are very important in this, especially in the past 20 to 30 years. And also broader social forces, things that are happening that are not necessarily good in our country, could be good, but those social forces, those kinds of movements like we've seen in the past 5, 6 years or so, can influence the group as well. That's number two, period events. And then there's a third category called cohort events. So these are very unique historical circumstances, such as the Great Depression, I've mentioned that. The moon landing, everybody knows where they were when they saw Neil Armstrong step off the lunar module and take a step on the moon. 9/11, very, very impactful to our nation at the time and so on, and was kind of the entrance of terrorism into our country. So everybody seems to remember that. And those who were alive at the time, it influenced them. So cohort events as well. Factors such as these, life cycle effects, period events, and cohort events, quicken and shorten the length of these age differences. But they also widen the gaps between them, even to the point of setting one against the other. One age may look at the experiences and all of these things that influenced an age that went before them or even afterwards and discount them, discount their experiences, discount what they went through and how those things changed them. And as a result, these age categories are getting much more clearly delineated, and it's increasing the gap. More people have less respect for other age groups now than we've ever had as a nation. And it usually happens with the younger groups looking back at the older groups, but it works the same. You can, if you talk to somebody in a silent gen or a baby boomer, they're looking at these new Gen Alphas and they're going, "What's wrong with the kids today? You know, why do they think this way? What are they doing? Well, how are they dressing? What's their language like? How do they call this music?" You know, all those kinds of things. We'll be looking down at those who would come after them as well from their individual perspective. We've all been taught to think this way. Largely, we've been carved up as a society to think this way. Satan's way is to divide and conquer. And you can see this on any number of levels, especially as pertains to marketing and advertising, those who are out to get money and power. Greed and lust for power in the institutions of men, all the institutions of men, drive this effort to carve us up. And that prince of the power of the air, as he's called in Ephesians 2 and verse 2, has been particularly effective since the beginning of this age of media. Media has ramped this up. It's driven this. What you watch, what you listen to, what you see, the entertainment that you like, and so on, is all embedded in this to categorize you. It's targeted at you specifically. It knows what you want. It goes after you. You see this in the marketing and advertising of cell phones, and especially the kind of apps that work on a cell phone. This is stuff that they study on campuses like Stanford University and others. They have these labs that consult with cell phone providers and app writers and say, well, if you're targeting women, this is what you need to go after. And it's usually categories of social interaction, social media. That's usually what the women are on. Then on the other side, if you're going after the boys, the young people, it needs to be games, some kind of interactive video game. And this is how you should design that to gain them as your customer. So this is it reached scientific levels, and it's become very effective. And as a result, we've become very good at creating and expanding generation gaps. But we are considerably worse at holding generations together. Why? You see some families, maybe some churches that are better at it than others, holding generations together through this onslaught of everything trying to carve us apart and make us think we're so much different, and that to devalue others' experiences in their lives. And if they're over a certain age, you don't even listen to them. Or if they're under a certain age, you don't even give them any credit for what they're experiencing and how they're handling it. Despite differences in age groups that are influenced by things like life cycle, period events, or cohort events, what is it that holds generations together? Why is it so lacking today? Let's look into that and understand how God thinks on this, how he tells us from his scriptures to value generations back and forward, and how we can make that happen going forward. Largely, it has to do with us living the truth in love within our families, within our churches, and having appreciation for every generational group, age group, regardless. Let's look at this first from the perspective of what God meant for age groups. And he meant for us, as you read in Scripture, to appreciate one another. From the perspective of family, as parents love their children, as children love and obey their parents, as they love their grandparents. I've experienced that. Could I have somebody bring me a little bottle of water or something, please? My throat's drying and there's not one up here. Thank you. Sorry. I'll just wait. I'm kidding. They can listen to the recording afterwards and fill in the gaps. I never understood grandparent love because I wasn't a grandparent. And I had four kids to rear, so my approach toward them was much more strict and focused, and having great expectations for them and so on. My parents were not like them toward that at all. In fact, my parents once challenged me because I gave my oldest, when she was very little, thank you, Tom, when she was very little, I gave her a choice. Okay, we're actually staying at my parents' place in Maine. I was playing cards with my parents. I think Renee was dealing with Chelsea, trying to get her to go to sleep. And Courtney did something wrong, and I said, okay, you can have a timeout or a spanking. But they always choose timeout. That's why you give them the choice. If they make the choice, they're much more willing to sit there in a timeout than the reverse. So she said timeout, so I sat them down. I sat her down, she's in a timeout. So I went back to playing cards. And without looking up from her cards, my mother says, so Brian, do you spank your children because we never spanked you? And I went, what? I said, I could tell you all the stories of being spanked. And I started rattling through all these. One of the worst was when they woke me up at like 4 in the morning because I forgot to take the garbage out. And I'm waking up to my parents not beating me, but they were frantically angry and slapping me under on top of the blankets and so on. So it wasn't like they hurt me at all. But they were crazy because I didn't pick out the garbage. And I said, well, I just forgot. They said, you always forget. We actually put the garbage. We collected it from all over the house, and we put it in the back door right against the door. So you had to push your way through it to step over it to get in to go to bed. And I said, that's what? I didn't know what was in those black bags. So at 4 in the morning in the winter, I had to carry the garbage out of my pajamas to the front. So I'm telling him all these stories, and more than that. And my mother says, you're exaggerating those. And my father, the whole time, his cards just keep getting higher. So you forget, you become a grandparent, and you completely forget. Something happens to you biologically where you forget about parenting. You forget about the need for disciplining your children and being, holding them to their expectations, your own, and so on. You forget all that. And it just now you just, they're okay, they're fine. Here, let them have some candy. My wife's mother, we were visiting for a weekend. I think it was Thanksgiving, but it wasn't the Thanksgiving meal. The dinner wasn't ready yet, and the kids were hungry. So what her mother did was pull out the banana pudding prior to dinner and starts serving her grandchildren banana pudding. And my wife says, "Who is this woman? We never got dessert before dinner." It's just something that changes you over time. Okay, I don't know how I got to that story, but largely this is an experience within family. When families are strong, these generational differences aren't as intense. They don't separate so much. In Proverbs 20 and verse 29, you can just write that down. It's a great principle. It says, "The glory of young men is their strength, and the splendor of old men is their gray head." The New Living Translation translates that this way. "The glory of the young is their strength, and the gray hair of experience is the splendor of the old." Young is associated with strength, enthusiasm, vigor, wanting to do things, wanting to accomplish things. The older are experience, not just in how to do things, but in how not to do things. And that is a perfect blending example of how God put families together. The parents have been through this. And if the children respect their parents' experience, they will learn from that experience. At the same time, when the parents expect the vigor and the strength and the enthusiasm of their children, they will give them opportunities to do things. They'll get them involved, and they'll make sure that they're active and so on. They won't be trying to stop them. And they'll appreciate their opinions as well. Let's look at this from three categories. First, the youth, secondarily parents, and then third, from the perspective of grandparents or those who are silver-haired. Youth have a strength and an enthusiasm. They have better health usually than their parents or grandparents. They have more energy. The young are filled with that kind of desire to do things, but it fades as we age. When Joseph went before Pharaoh, Pharaoh was probably older. Joseph was about 30 or so. And he had this ability, not just in terms of intellect and managing businesses and so on, but how much energy must that have taken him to organize over that 7 years of plenty and prepare for the 7 years of famine. And he did that all for Pharaoh. He was number two in the nation. And in terms of actually accomplishing things, he was probably doing more than Pharaoh was. But Pharaoh understood that. He saw that in him. He chose him to do that. You could see the same thing as Daniel before Nebuchadnezzar. When he recognized Daniel's character and his strength, his vitality, how he can do things and accomplish things, he relied on him as well. Same thing when you look at the example of David before Goliath. It took somebody in his youth, maybe to a great degree naive, but having all kinds of fire and wanting to do things for Israel, fight for God, and so on. He also knew that he had just been an anointed king, so he knew nothing was going to happen to him. God would not allow that to happen. So he went charging down that mountainside to take on Goliath, when the rest of the older men there in the army, the experienced ones, didn't want to do that. When faith in God combines with the exuberance of youth, it can be a very powerful force, but strength and enthusiasm are often accompanied by a sense of arrogance. I know what I'm doing. I know what should be done here, and I don't need to listen to those who went before me. I don't need that experience. I can get my own experience. Look at 1 Kings 12 here. This is a great example of this, example of a mistake that was made. 1 Kings 12, we'll read verses 6 through 10. This is the example when Rehoboam, this is Solomon's son, took over as king and was meeting with Israel. And Israel was making a request to lighten our burden, the taxes and so on. 6 through 10 of 1 Kings 12. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he still lived, and he said, "How do you advise me to answer these people?" In other words, what should I do in terms of, should I be lowering taxes? Verse 7, and they spoke to him, saying, "If you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever." That's a great lesson in leadership, by the way. And the directive from God in Matthew 20, that if you want to lead, serve. It's always about serving. Verse 8, but he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. This is a penchant of the young. And I saw this even in my own daughters. I've seen it in many youth in the church. They tend to listen to their friends more than they listen to their own parents or seek the advice of those who are older. And largely because they don't have the experience of relying on experience. Parents can give that to them, share that with them, and help them to understand how valuable that kind of advice is when they're in the home. But absent of that, you don't even know it. You don't even think it. But Rehoboam, in this case, relied more on his friends, younger people, less experienced people. And they were all caught up in power and potentially greed for power. Let's read verse 8 again, then I'll read into verse 10. But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him who stood before him. And he said to them, "What advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, 'Lighten the yoke which your father put on us'?" Verse 10 then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, "Thus you should speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us.' Thus you shall say to them, 'My little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist.'" He was telling them he was going to tax them more. He was going to make their burden bigger. Caught up in his youth and his power and his enthusiasm, he took the wrong advice. And it led to splitting Israel. Look at verse 19. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Now God says here that this was his idea. This was his plan. He put this together and he allowed it to happen for that express purpose. Again, the tendency of our young ones is to rely on friends over parents and elderly. It's very unwise to discount the energy and strength of our youth for those who are older. But it's also equally foolish for our young to ignore, even disdain, the experience of our elderly, which is what we see more and more in this age. It's not just a penchant of Israel, but it seems like that. The next category I said here was parents. Parents provide guidance and a loving example that should not be discounted by either the children or those who are older than the parents who have responsibility for their children. Now, our nation is changing in this respect. Largely the growth of public schools and so on, you can hear people say there's a mistaken idea in our country that parents are responsible for their children, that parents or the children belong to their parents. You can hear politicians, you can pull up recordings on this online and see what they say. No, that's not true. Our children belong to all of us. Now, they were saying that from the perspective of being involved in rearing the children, but they totally, utterly discounted the parents' responsibility and the gift of family that God has given us. Let's look at Exodus 20, verse 12 here. This is the commandment. And we'll see this, you can see this throughout Scripture. I can't go to all of these Scriptures, obviously. But we'll go to some key ones here where we see the importance of parents in the rearing of children and also and the influence that they have on all of society, not just by rearing their children, but setting a right example of what a family should look like. Exodus 20 and verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. This is a very interesting wording here. This is the first commandment that is directed toward loving your fellow neighbor. The first four, we've always said, are loving God. The next six are loving your neighbor. It's interesting that the first one of these commandments is to the children, the offspring. Now, they wouldn't understand this at age 2, 3, or 4, but loving parents would lead them to understand how important that is for them to do this, to honor their father and mother. And then as they are reared in that example, they understand it even better. Deuteronomy 5 and verse 16 is another example of this. It's just a repeating of the commandment. So Exodus 20, verse 12, also Deuteronomy 5 and verse 16. Look at Leviticus 19 here, though. Leviticus 19 and verse 3. This is a term that's not used much anymore because most people don't think in the light of God's presence, in the light of God's word and his truth. As a result, we dampen this word down. It's usually respect or something else. This is Leviticus 19 and verse 3. Every one of you shall revere his mother and father. Reverence is usually something that's held for God only. But in this case, because of the design of family, those positions of mother and father, regardless of the people who own them, this is not a personal kind of evaluation. Should I honor this person? Should I revere this person? You honor the positions of mother and you honor the positions of father as child, as offspring. And keep my Sabbath, I am the Lord your God. It's interesting that's combined with keep my Sabbath, which we all tend to get, but we often forget that first one. We don't revere our parents, and we need to, by God's design. It's more of a reverence for God's design for family here. Look at Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6, we'll look at verses 6 through 9. And this is, I made reference earlier to a process by how this happens. This is the process. How children are reared in the truth, in living the truth in love, and establishing a foundation for fighting against those generational gaps and the divisive nature of the world around us. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 6. And these words I command you today shall be in your heart. It's not just a matter to know them in your head. In your heart, you're inclined to do them, act on them. Whereas if it's just in your head, it's just academic knowledge. You may be able to regurgitate it to somebody who asked you a question, but this has to much more to do with having that law written into the hearts and minds. Verse 7, you shall teach them diligently to your children, diligently, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and gates, and on your gates. This living the truth is so much more important than simply knowing it. It has to be lived by us, and our children need to see it. Children will know if you act differently at church than you do at home. They will know it when you treat people outside the home differently than you treat them and your family within the home. When that's guided by the truth itself, when you're living the truth from your heart in and out of the home, the children see that, and that it either engenders them or pushes them away when we don't do it. It just seems hypocritical to them. We need to reverence our parents. And the process is that the parents model the way that the children see and then model for their children. This is what holds generations together, the living of the truth in love. I'll just read this one for you, Proverbs 1, verses 8 and 9. Proverbs 1, 8 and 9 says, my son, hear the instruction of your father, and do not forsake the law of your mother, for they will be a graceful ornament on your head and chains about your neck. They will decorate you. When you obey your parents, when you don't forsake them, when you revere them and keep God's commandments relative to parents, you will be dressed in beautiful attire. People will recognize it. They'll notice it. You will live a rich life. Look at Proverbs chapter 4 here. Proverbs chapter 4, we'll read verses 1 through 6. Again, Proverbs is just filled with instructions on honoring parents. And honoring, after this, we'll cover this, the hoary head, the silver-haired. Proverbs 4, verse 1. Hear, my children, the instruction of a father, and give attention to no understanding, for I give you good doctrine, good teaching. Do not forsake my law, when I was my father's son, tender and the only one in the sight of my mother, he also taught me and said to me, let your heart retain my words, keep my commandments and live, get wisdom, get understanding, do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her in reference to wisdom, and she will preserve you. Love her, and she will keep you. When we do not forsake God's law, that means we are living it. So when God reveals the truth, we recognize it for the value that it is, not just in knowing it, but in actually living it. I'll share this with the elders tomorrow. We're having a meeting tomorrow. We talk about this in the Council of Elders all the time. The concept of knowing the truth versus living the truth. It's one of the biggest problems we have in our media today. We project knowledge. We give the truth. And we get all kinds of requests into the millions for booklets and articles. And we have over 300,000 subscribers to the magazine, the Beyond Today magazine. We get viewership. People watch Beyond Today television as well at very good rates for how small we are. But we also have the United News going out to over 50,000 people, coworkers and so on. But no one's responding by coming to attend with us. You notice that? In the 28 years of United, we have gone from 20,000 in the U.S. down to 7,000. Why? I think the Beyond Today work, the magazine and the television, are some of the highest production value stuff we've ever presented. Some of our booklets are just awesome. The one on the Trinity, the one on the covenants, those are just great books, thick, well done, and many amazingly done. And we get requests for those all the time. But something's happening in the mind of those who gather the knowledge but don't respond by attending with a group that has this knowledge. They don't want to live it. They don't want to apply the truth. If they do, they want to do it on their own without having to rely on others and the stickiness of relationships. We've got to find some way of changing that. This is largely where we're focusing on the concept of truth and love. We've got to bridge that gap. By the way, some of you may have heard some people touching on the logo itself, and not the logo, the seal. We don't have the seal here, but the seal is not a logo. I hear people referring to it as our old logo. It's not a logo. It was never meant to be a logo. When you shrink that down in digital space, it looks like a penny. And you can't make a relationship between that and the stuff that we offer in the digital space. That means all of our booklets, the magazine, Beyond Today, and so on. People don't connect all of that material to the idea that there is a church behind this, that there are people who give their tithes and offerings so they can get this for free. I don't say free. With no charge to them. It's not free. It's paid for by the tithes and offerings of the loving, generous people of the United Church of God. But they don't see that. They don't get that. There's no desire in them to actually follow that up. And amongst our youth today, this is Gen Ys and Gen Zs, millennials and Gen Alphas, they don't have an interest in attending church at all. They don't see a need to share what they believe with others who believe the same things. That's a huge obstacle to overcome in our young people that are out there. So we've got to find some way of bridging that as well. The logo, whatever it ends up being, needs to bridge those two. If on every one of our booklets, articles, and so on, we have that logo, and we also see that with respect to the church itself, then they make a connection between the two. It's something we haven't had in 28 years. And it's led to this decline where people just have no interest in attending. That against market forces have been very difficult to overcome. Going back to Proverbs 4 and verses 1 through 6, we need to rekindle appreciation for wisdom. There's this mentality in our country today that everybody needs to experience it for themselves. Largely, it's because of the loss of the truth. No absolute truths. Everybody has their own truth. Sound familiar? Only what was relative to you in your life, your experiences, what you went through, your age category, and so on, that's unique to you. We train our children in this. In the old one-room schoolhouse with 20, 25 kids in it, ages 5 through 18 all learned together. At some point in time, the older kids in that classroom would teach the younger kids and learn even better as a result of teaching. That doesn't happen anymore. All the one-year-olds go to the same classes together, no interaction with others. So the two-year-olds and three and four. When they move into high school, that's epidemic. Freshmen don't interact with sophomores. No, juniors don't interact with seniors. In fact, there's an animosity between them all. I know this because when I was a freshman, the sophomores hated me. Well, they hated all freshmen. That's why they go through initiation. Did you have initiation in your high school? They probably discouraged that now. It was usually getting your face painted with lipstick on the first day of school. So you tried everything you possibly could not to look like a freshman. When I started high school, I was under 5 feet tall and I weighed less than 100 pounds. And my mother dressed me up in really colorful clothing. green jeans, not blue jeans, with yellow and maroon stripes in them, with a flowery disco shirt. John Travolta, what was that movie called? Saturday Night Fever? Yeah. That's how I went to school on the first day. So I knew how to avoid people, how to get in the side door, how to hide. At that size, I could actually hide in my locker. So as I grew, it got a little easier. But I remember the same animosity as a sophomore toward the freshman again. So it's just when you divide, it's easier to create these kinds of separations between people. It's just moving in the completely wrong direction. Okay. Proverbs 6 and verse 20, I'll just read this for you. Proverbs 6:20 says, "My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother." Proverbs 23, verses 22, or just verse 22. "Listen to your father who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she is old." We need to encourage our young people to actually go to their parents for advice. Go to the elderly people in the congregation and let them be able to talk to them. It's just not something that our culture is used to. I've noticed this when I first started attending church back in 1982, that the kids in the church would come up and talk to you. So if you were talking with two or three people in a group, the little one, like 8, 9, 10 years old, would walk up to the group and stand there and listen. And occasionally would have something to say. I remember being shocked by that. You don't see that anywhere else in society. Because kids are taught. You hang around your own group, hang around your old people. Don't take the older people into consideration. Something that's very important, though. Look at Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4. Ephesians 6. I'm spending more time on this one with the parents. We'll shorten it when we get into the grandparents, but that's very important as well. Ephesians chapter 6, and we'll read verses 1 through 4. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." That's a very interesting dynamic, because women, even though sometimes in wedding vows out in the world, they're not told but in the scriptures to obey their parents. If you look up the word for obey when it's used in reference to a wife, it's the same word that's there for submission. I can't think of the word now. And that's very different than obey. Wives are not told by God to obey their husbands. That's more of a partnership. It's not like men should be barking out commands to their wives. They need to work this stuff out together. They're both heirs of salvation, so they work together. He leads, obviously, but she follows with respect and submission, and that's the way that works. Children are different. He says here specifically, "Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment, with promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. And you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." That's very different than what most people think a strict parent would do. A training and admonition of the Lord certainly speaks to discipline in your children, disciplining your children so they can make right choices as they grow. But parents, in God's mind, always trump friends. Hear that, young people. Parents always trump friends. Don't rely on someone you know with no experience, no background, no understanding, who's growing probably less maturely than you are at that point, when you have the wisdom of your parents or the elderly in your church, aunts and uncles and so on, that you can go to for advice. That's the biblical way. It's not the way the society around us, though. God's, in God's mind, in his teaching, Parents should always trump friends, especially godly parents. All right, last category here. Grandparents and elderly. The grandparents, because of their experience and their desire and love for their children especially, and the elderly, like within a church, so many of our elderly look down with grandparenty love. Is that a word, grandparenty? Love toward the younger people in the church. You see that all the time. But both provide wisdom and stability for our youth. And in an age where children are pushed all the time and have so many ways they can go, so many opportunities in the wealth of our nation, having that kind of wisdom is important. Job 12:12 says this, Job 12 and verse 12. Wisdom is with aged men, and with length of days, understanding. Leviticus 19 and verse 32 says, you shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man, and fear your God. I am the Lord. And again, the combination here is striking. So showing respect to a gray-headed man, the presence of an old man, is associated with fearing your God. Look at Job here, Job 32. This is the section of the book where Elihu, who's been apparently listening all through this, Job's three friends giving him bad advice and Job fighting back and so on. Now Elihu speaks. This is Job 32. And we'll just read verses 4 through 9. Elihu here expresses the wisdom of respect for the elderly. But he also associates it with leaning always to the righteous. These men, as God said at the end of this book, that these men were not being righteous. They were not telling Job what he should have needed to hear. So Job 32, let's read verses 4 through 9. Now because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job out of respect for them and their age. Wisdom should speak until he heard what they said and recognized that they were not right. Verse 5. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was aroused. So Elihu, the son of Barakel, this is interesting. It's something we should always remember. Passion is not arrogance. Elihu waited 31 chapters before he opened his mouth, but he was angry because they did not respond to Job what he needed to hear. Passion is not arrogance. Neither is passiveness humility. I'm going to be speaking on that in the coming weeks. What is false humility? And how dangerous is that for us to fall into? Sort of being self-effacing instead of truly understanding the value that we have. That can be a very dangerous hole to fall into in another couple of weeks. Verse 6, so Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzite, answered and said, I am young in years, and you are very old. Therefore I was afraid and dared not declare my opinion to you. You see that in any of our youth today? I have seen deacons in our church challenge 17, 18-year-olds. And the 17 and 18-year-olds, when they challenge them, it's like they have the same opinion of themselves as they do with someone who's 50, 60 years old, who's raised children, who has a degree, who has a job, a good one, and has taken care of his family. Where's the humility in the part of a 17 or 18-year-old who's challenging a man like that? He's challenging from the perspective of his own cohort, his own age group, his own generation, without respecting what the man he was talking to went through. Therefore, I was afraid, he said, and dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom. And that's correct. That's biblical. But there is a spirit in man, he said, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. So he expresses respect for their wisdom and their age, but he was deferring here to righteousness. That's why he waited, but he was compelled to speak up when he saw that their answers were not right. I'll give you another scripture here in Proverbs 16. And verse 31, the silver-haired head is a crown of glory, something that we should notice and respect. Back in here, especially, if you lived long enough to get gray hair, you knew something about life. Okay, we could say if you live long enough to have no hair, you have some information about life that would be helpful to those who may have hair but don't have that wisdom. And throughout the scriptures, the youth are taught to go to those who are older out of respect for their experience in life. The silver-haired head is a crown of glory if it is found in the way of righteousness. That's the key. It still has to be founded in the way of righteousness. Now, you can still learn from somebody who's not righteous, who maybe doesn't understand God, doesn't even read the Bible, depending on what their expertise is. You want to buy a car, go talk to an older mechanic. If you want to, you're looking at what college you should go to, talk to an older teacher and get some feedback from them. You don't have to do what they say, but their information can help you to make a good decision, especially within the church. If you're struggling with anything of what God wants us to do from the scriptures, talk to our elders, talk to our deacons. They're the ones who've experienced what you're going through. Most of them that I know of, at least here, were reared in the church anyway. So don't think that your experience is unique to your generation. So, but the key is found in the way of righteousness. The last thing I want to cover here has to do with generations who are growing apart from each other because we no longer share in absolute truth in our country, in the world. When God gets put away, truth gets put away. And at that point, everything breaks down in terms of what would bind these generations together. Now, that helps those who want to take from generations individually, divide and conquer. You want to make money off a generation. You want to specifically define them, separate them from others, and you carve up the entirety of society. That's what we're seeing now in spades. In 1882, when Nietzsche, the philosopher, wrote God is Dead, he was commenting on the fundamental belief system of the West. I mean, he was an atheist, so he was not saying that God had died. He was observing that belief in God had died that long ago. And it set a foundation for the entirety of the breakout, or the unfolding, I should say, of the last century. And now in this century, it's over the top. In Nietzsche's work, Twilight of the Idols, he wrote this, quote, "When one gives up the Christian faith, one pulls the right to Christian morality out from under one's feet. This morality is by no means self-evident. Christianity is a system, a whole view of things thought out together. By breaking one main concept out of it, the faith in God, one breaks the whole," unquote. So when belief in the author of absolute truth dies, belief in him dies, truth becomes subject to one's limited experience, like life stage, like period effects that have influenced us, like cohort effects and their influence. Then at some point, experiences outside of one's age group or generation become immaterial to us. They become irrelevant, and they even become threatening, and gaps between the generations grow. What holds that together, or what used to hold it together, was absolute truth. We're individuals who had taken a responsibility to live the truth in love, and so taught their children. Then generation after generation, the healing process begins. We won't see that in this age. That's not the direction it's going in. But we need to know this to teach those in the millennium what holds them together. With no common frame of reference, no shared moral compass, the bridges between generations collapse. And this is what we're living in today. If you want to build bridges of appreciation with all generations, begin with your own family's sharing and agreement in the truth and how to live it. And then in that practice, you will engender others who want to do the same, including our youth and including our elderly. Brethren, truth is what holds generations together. Those who live the truth in love learn to appreciate God's design for family and his plan for all of humanity. And it won't really matter what generation we're in at that point. When we do this, when we live the truth in love, we learn to appreciate each generation according to the word of God and not the dictates of media.